This episode is brought to you in part by the Table Podcast from the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Daryl Bach, one of the hosts, and I invite you to join us as we discuss issues of God and culture, which includes anything and everything. Listen on your podcast app or at dts.edu/thetable.
We spend a lot of time on podcasts like this predicting the future in various ways. But as we do that, we know life is really unpredictable. And as the scripture says, we do not know the number of our days. And that's why it's a really important thing to have a will, to protect yourself and your family. Christianity Today has partnered with Epic Will to walk you through the entire process of creating a will in as little as 10 minutes. You don't have to have a law degree to be able to walk through this, and that's why it's really helpful. So visit morect.com, that's morct.com, will, that's morect.com/will to get started today. Russell Moore, and you're listening to The Russell Moore Show, brought to you by Christianity Today. Every week, we explore here conversations and questions from a Christian perspective to help you sort out how to live as a follower of Jesus in confusing times. This week, we have a conversation to seek to do just that. We're here today with Andy Crouch, who is with Praxis, an organization dealing with redemptive entrepreneurship, all kinds of interesting things happening at Praxis. Many of you are familiar with Andy Crouch's work in several of his books that have been really, really, I almost said impactful. And we'll talk about later why that's bad.
Watch out, Russell.
I don't even know why I did that, because I never use that word ordinarily. But we're going to be talking about his new book, The Life We're Looking For, Reclaiming Relationship in a Technological World. And one of the reasons I'm really interested in having this conversation is when you all send me questions every week, I'm surprised by how many of them have to do with this question, with how to be human in a technological world, whether it's a teenager, college student, parents, or others who are dealing with this. It used to be that most of those questions were about porn, and that's certainly a worthy subject, but a lot more of them now having to do with just the general sense of feeling overwhelmed in a technological age. And so that's why this book is really, really important for right now, and I think you're going to benefit from this conversation. Andy, thanks so much for being with us today.
It is a pleasure. Thank you, Russell.
I'm wondering if maybe this is just me, but I find that when I write, it's usually because of something that I'm grappling with and I'm thinking about. Writing a book on adoption, it was largely because I was trying to work through why I was so reluctant initially to adopt.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's true for you. If there was a time in your life in which you started to realize, wait a minute, this technology and the technological age, it's starting to change me or change someone that I love. Did you ever have a moment like that?
Oh, it's interesting that you ask, because I think there's actually two components to it. One is that technology, I don't know if it was my first love. I think music was my first love. I got that from my mother, who was a classical pianist, and I learned music very early on. But I got tech from my dad, who brought home a computer modem or a computer terminal. This will make no sense to anyone under the age of 60. But back in the day, you connected to the mainframe computers of places like the university where my dad taught over the phone lines. And he brought this home when I was like 10 years old. And I learned to code very early on. I mean, really, really early on. I was using punch cards at the very beginning as a 10, 11, 12-year-old and just became absolutely kind of intoxicated with coding, with programming, with what was becoming possible. And so the first level is that this has been a big part of my life, even though it's not ended up being my like life's work. It's just a fascination that I've had since I was young. And if you had asked me when I was 11 or 12 years old, what are you going to do when you grow up? I would have said, I'm going to be a programmer, even though that turned out not at all to be the case. I would say the second thing that happened in my case was marriage. interestingly, to an experimental physicist, Catherine uses all kinds of high tech at work. But what I started to realize in the early years of our marriage, and even more dramatically once we had children, was that my relationship with the technology that I surrounded myself with was disordered. And this was before the iPhone. This was before, I mean, it was very early days of the internet. But I just had there was a lure to these devices in my own life that interfered with the most important relationships in my life. So my wife gently, lovingly, patiently, and mostly patiently, sometimes impatiently confronted me with that. So in a way I have been wrestling with this, just at a personal level, kind of, it's my whole life story is bound up in these technological developments that are now part of all of our lives in many ways.
You know, it seems that people have different kinds of problems when it comes to relating to technology. In your case, were you more of the, I'm finding my attention span splintered apart by this, or was it more, I'm kind of drawn into controversies that I don't want to be a part of, or was it more, I'm starting to care more about what these people think of me than the people that I love, or maybe it was right. It was something of all of it.
I think, well, all of those have happened. I've sensed all those things happening to me and have had to deal with them. But I actually think first it was a slightly different thing. And this maybe isn't normal, although maybe it's more normal than we realize. It actually didn't have to do with the social worlds that open up through media and technology initially. It really was this experience that I talk about in this book as the experience of superpowers. The ability to get a computer to do things in certain ways really fast, really effectively, with a kind of minimum of effort, or at least a certain kind of effort is very minimal. And that sense of exhilaration when the thing actually works and the program runs and it does the thing you asked it to do, and it obeys you in a way and serves you in a way that other people don't. Other people are much more complicated to get them to do what you want them to do, including spouses and children. And so for me, the first layer of distortion was I just had to confront how much I liked that sense of being in control when I was at the computer keyboard. And then later came realizing, oh, wow, now that this can present to me a whole world of people, or the simulations of people, or the avatars of people who I can form a kind of imaginary relationship to, that became another level of conflict and competition for the actual people God had put in my life and the actual work God had put before me with real people.
My kids asked me one time, we were talking about, I grew up in a place in which hurricanes would come through periodically. And I was talking about the process of being without power and so forth after hurricanes. And one of my kids said, how long would it be before the Wi-Fi would come back up? And I had to say, this was the 1980s. Nobody had Wi-Fi. I think there was a time when people assumed the problems would be for digital natives. For people who grew up with this technology, and that does bring its own problems, but it is as much or more so an issue for people who didn't grow up with all of these devices and are kind of overwhelmed by this kind of world. Have you seen that?
Yes, for sure. I think in some ways, especially this emerging cohort of young adults, let's say my children are 25 and 22, I'd put them in this category. in some ways they grew up with the ambiguity of many of these things. The social media was already there when they were going into middle school and high school. And they actually maybe developed better immune systems or a better sense, a better kind of threat response. Like, this isn't all good. I actually think for some people who kind of got on Facebook, let's say, in midlife without any immunity, and without kind of seeing the risks of it, it can be actually more in all encompassing, addictive, habit forming, dependency creating. Because partly, you know, everyone talks about how much younger people use screens. But the truth is, older people are using screens a lot. And when we did some research for my daughter's book, My Tech-Wise Life, which was her own perspective on these matters as a late teenager, the number one thing teenagers said when we asked them, what do you wish you could change in your relationship with your parents? They said, I wish my parents would spend less time on their screens and more time talking to me. That's what the kids want.
Yeah.
So I do think those who kind of adopt it in the middle, the so-called digital immigrants, though I don't actually believe there's exactly such a thing as digital natives, but those who arrive at it without developing the immune system actually can become very dependent on it as well.
I find the title of your book actually really subversively revealing in its own way, because it's the life that we're looking for. Yeah. And that with some things, it seems what we have to do is to convince people this is the life you should want.
Yes.
The way that you're going, it seems to be working, but it's really not long term. In this case, it seems that there are very few people who would say, I'm really happy with the way that my relationships take place in this kind of an era. People are exhausted or run down. Right. They just don't know how to, they don't know how to do anything else. They don't know how to get out of it.
I think this is one of the most interesting and actually in a strange way, hopeful aspects of our current moment is the dissatisfaction is universal. There's a pretty universal sense. This is not working. And it extends all the way to people who are actually building this stuff. You know, the engineer who invented the Facebook like button and wrote the blog post that introduced that thumbs up, if you remember that, she has eliminated the Facebook newsfeed from her computer. Like she's created a plugin to get rid of the whole thing. And so the very people who developed it, Tony Fadell, who invented the iPod and was very involved in the development of the iPhone at Apple, told Fast Company, I think it was, he said, I wake up in cold sweats at night asking, what did we bring into the world? And he was specifically referring to his own teenage kids who were growing up in this world that his device, in a way, had created. So there's kind of a universal quest, I think, right now to figure out how do we live a truly human life in this world of devices. And I actually find that an incredibly fruitful moment rather than most people being like, oh, it's fine. What are you complaining about? There's hardly anyone who feels that way.
I found really moving in the book your discussion of mirroring, of what it is for a child to really need to be seen and to have someone looking back at him or her. And it kept coming to mind. I was teaching this past weekend on Hagar in the book of Genesis.
Yes.
And you are the God who sees.
That's right.
Someone who was invisible in many categories, but she was seen in that way. And then the way that Jesus is seeing Nathaniel, well, you're under the fig tree, and the woman at the well tells me everything that I've done, and she's really seen and acknowledged. And it was really moving to me to think about that primal sort of quest to be seen and to be acknowledged. And It really, I think there's something disrupted there that goes beyond what we even acknowledge. I mean, what prompted you to start really thinking about that primal longing for being seen?
Well, I think it actually was, in this context, I started thinking about it when I heard, when I talked with parents about how their children felt about the parents' technology use, kind of related to what I mentioned a moment ago. I remember a woman who was a very accomplished and a professional, admirable person in every way, clearly a dedicated mother, but she described this kind of wrenching moment when her maybe 2 or 3 year old, maybe early childhood child, the mom was sitting on the couch, working on her laptop, trying to get some email done, as professionals now have to do round the clock. You know, we work from home, we work from everywhere. And her daughter interposed her face between her mom's face and the computer keyboard, and said, "Mom, look at me," with this kind of desperate tone. And it was this wake-up call for this mom, who of course loves her daughter and of course wants to look at her and delight in her, but that somehow her attention was being diverted. And I think you are right that this has been disrupted. We are made for one another's gaze. We have more neurons dedicated to recognizing faces than anything else. We're built that way from the moment we arrive in the world, and we have this thing that you mentioned, these mirror neurons that actually don't just recognize another face, but actually mirror in our own neurological system what we imagine and can tell the other person is experiencing and doing, down to motor neurons. If I lift my arm, there's a set of neurons in your body that actually act as if you are lifting your arm, that mirror what I'm doing. It's quite amazing, right?
Yeah.
But above all, the ability to attend to the dozens and dozens of muscle groups in the human face that communicate emotion, that communicate attention, that communicate presence. And this has always been the most compelling thing for human beings. But I mean, let's ask ourselves honestly, if you and I were together in person, and you were sitting across from me, we're doing this interview remotely, but if you were sitting across from me in real life and there was a TV right next to you, showing, be it whatever, it could be the World Cup, it could be a soap opera, it could be a stupid ad I've seen 10 times. You know, my attention would be diverted to that screen. There is something about these glowing rectangles of all kinds, the entertainment kinds, but maybe even more so the laptop, that allows me to project myself with power and efficacy into the world. That grabs my attention in a way that displaces my ability to actually pay attention to a face. And when you think about how much time all of us are spending immersed in these kind of very shallow, very shallow mirrors of ourselves, through personal computing, we are missing out on that face-to-face relationship that up until the blink of an eye ago in human history was the most compelling reality any human being ever encountered, was another person who looked at them, regarded them, interacted with them. And now we're all competing and having to force ourselves. Like, I'm out to dinner with my wife and I have to force myself to pay attention to this face and this person rather than the screen that's just over her shoulder.
Well, and there are a lot of conversations going on right now necessarily about narcissism because of things that are happening in the church, things that are happening in the political arena and other places. And I think there are a lot of people who assume narcissism comes from too much recognition. Parents are they're helicoptering, or they're giving participation trophies, and children have too much self-esteem, when in reality it's the reverse.
It's the lack. That bottomless well of, has anyone really seen me in a long time, known me? Was I ever seen and known? Oh man. Yeah, I agree.
Well, when you're thinking about these issues of navigating, living in this kind of technological world, you talk about in the book superpowers. And the first thing that came to my mind was a segment on This American Life from several years ago about this experiment of asking people, would you rather have the power of flight or the power of invisibility?
Yes.
How revealing that question
was. One of the most haunting episodes of This American Life ever produced.
it really was. And I really, for our listeners, I encourage you to listen to it, because one of the things that they found was that most people would say flight initially.
Yeah.
And then they would move to invisibility. And the longer that one talked, the more the invisibility was to do fallen things, yeah, and to have it really expose the shadow side.
Yes.
But I thought about that when you're talking about superpowers and the sense that we are looking for and maybe have the illusion of superpowers. What explain to our listeners what that looks like.
Yeah, it's so interesting you bring up that episode, because when I think about superpowers, I think about essentially effortless efficacy, effortless power. That is, it's the combination of being able to get something done on the one hand, but to get it done with very little effort, cost, or apparent expense to oneself. It's pushing a button and having something happen that you want to have happen, or to summon something, whether it's information or entertainment or, you know, another person, the simulation of another person's presence, and you just press a button and it happens. And I would call all of that kind of the technological promise that lures us. Really, we adopt technology either because it's going to make our lives just effortless without effect. Like, I just don't even have to worry about doing the dishes anymore because I installed a dishwasher. Or because it will give us actually the ability to engage in a way in the world, but with very little investment or risk of ourselves. And this is where I think this question about, you know, if it came down to it, would you choose flight or invisibility? It was so revealing in that episode, because invisibility is about control and about minimizing risk. It's about being able to decide how and whether I'm seen, which is, if that's like our deepest need, right, then invisibility, the ability to prevent you from seeing me when I don't want to be seen, would seem like, in a way, the ultimate remedy for shame and the ultimate like license, in a way, for sin, right?
Yeah.
Whereas flight would be this experience, and I think they even talked about it in that episode because I remember it quite vividly. Flight would be this sort of exposure to the world. Like, you, even if you just, like Superman, just could decide to go, which is a kind of superpower, you still are sort of, you're out, going to be out in the wind and the wild and through the air, moving through the world. But I actually think what technology gives us is kind of both. That is, I get on the airplane, and it transports me kind of magically. I fly from one place to another, but with very little effort or development of myself, I kind of retreat into my little tiny seat with my, you know, my headphones and my reading material. It's amazing how little people talk to each other on airplanes now. That you and I maybe remember a few decades ago, that wasn't so true. You'd have conversations with people, but now we've got all these layers of technology that I plug in my headphones, and I'm now in my own kind of cocoon of a world. I'm not literally invisible, but I'm exercising a great deal of power, but with very, very little risk. And this also means that I exercise that power without becoming someone. There's no becoming involved in the exercise of superpowers. You just wish for it to be, or you press the button to make it so. And I think that's the distinctive promise of technology, but also the very real peril. Because I don't actually think we're made primarily to live that way. with effortless power.
Ashley here. If you're looking for another podcast that features inspiring conversations with religious leaders, authors, and artists, then I recommend listening to the acclaimed podcast, No Small Endeavor. Produced by Great Feelings Studios and PRX, No Small Endeavor explores what it means to live a good life. Each episode, host Lee C. Camp sits down with special guests like award-winning journalist and best-selling author Tim Alberta and civil rights hero Reverend James Lawson to ask what it means to live a life worth living. You can even hear from Russell Moore on No Small Endeavor. If you're looking for somewhere to start, check out their new episode with Malcolm Gladwell, New York Times best-selling author and host of the wildly popular podcast Revisionist History. They explore how Malcolm became a stellar storyteller, some of the things he may or may not regret, and so much more. Don't miss out. Follow No Small Endeavor wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you think that COVID made this worse? What was this just a kind of a bump in the road and things returned back to the status quo? Or did the pandemic really change things long term?
Going into it, my prior belief is that pandemics generally don't introduce drastically new things, but they do accelerate trends that already were happening. And I would say overall, I do think that's what happened with COVID. It's actually interesting. There are a number of indices of well-being of many, many kinds. How many close friends do people say they have? How much time do people spend out of doors? How much, like all these different questions that can be sliced and diced in different ways. And all of them, maybe the most dramatic are adolescent mental health kind of statistics. Yeah. All of them start diverging from the historical pattern in the middle of the 20-teens, 2015, 2016. We start to see these curves change slope, basically. The second derivative kind of starts to change. And that was before COVID. But it's also the case that the slope changes and gets even steeper in 2020, 2021. I think the really paradoxical thing is that we all got a taste of a completely virtualized life for a while. Yeah. Most people in most parts of the world, in the various kinds of lockdown that we experienced. And you would think, I mean, it clearly did produce a kind of aversion. Like we now talk about Zoom fatigue and we all know what that is. But I think it also produced a kind of paralysis and dependence. What I'm experiencing as I get back out into the world with people and with educators, with schools, with churches, is everybody knows it wasn't good, but it's like we were sapped of the will to go back out and seek the good together again. And that sense of futility and dependence is just overwhelming. And I run into this all the time talking to parents about their kids' device use. And, you know, families that had managed to have relatively healthy patterns, suddenly schools, you know, like families that didn't have devices in bedrooms, which is one of our family's number one principles. Well, suddenly the school is like, your kid needs to have a quiet place to join class. And so now you got devices in the bedrooms.
Yeah.
And everybody saw this was not good. I mean, hardly anyone, kids, adults, anybody thinks that was good. But what I also hear is that ship has sailed. We can't get the devices back out of the bedrooms now. They were in school for a year and a half that way. It's just over. And there's this sense of futility and resignation, I think, that is really a little surprising to me. I thought it would create more of an aversive reaction where we'd say never again. But in fact, it seems to be like, well, this is just the way it is now, which I do not believe is true and doesn't have to be true.
Well, and even just adult friendships, it seems that people kind of lost the muscle memory of how to connect with one another in real life.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, true for adults, even more true for adolescents. I went into the pandemic most concerned about, if you had to pick like one social issue I was concerned about, it was reading loss, literacy loss among 8 to 10 year olds, because there's this window of time when you're 8 to 10 years old, it seems, according to scholars like Marianne Wolfe who study this, that if you don't acquire literacy in that window, it's very hard to ever pick it up later. And that has happened. That is genuinely going to be an issue that we'll live with for 100 years in a way in the West, because of those couple of years of loss. But what I hadn't thought about was the way that there may be a similar window in early adolescence, say 12 to 14, 13 to 15, something like that, where you kind of have that opportunity to figure out how to be a person with other persons, which is so hard and awkward and complicated. And a whole cohort of middle schoolers just missed it. And who knows if they ever fully catch up. But also who knows whether even those of us who just were deprived of it for a while ever take the risks again, because ultimately what technology promises you is a life of reduced risk. But I don't believe that's the life we're actually looking for. I think the life of love is a life of risk, but are we going to choose it? That's the huge question, at personal, family, community, church, social levels.
I had an ouch moment when I was reading this book, because I remembered the time that one of my children, my youngest son, said, "Has the Amazon run today?" As though he's talking about, has the mail run or something like that. It just assuming, is it a holiday that there's not an Amazon package? And I was thinking about the fact that there are Amazon delivery people who come here a lot. I wouldn't be able to tell you a name for any of them. I wouldn't be able to identify someone's face in a mugshot at all. And you talk about in the book about how mammon, and particularly kind of the way that we do commerce, depersonalizes and can depersonalize. And I thought as I was reading that, that's exactly, that's exactly what has happened. Talk to us a little bit about how that happens and why.
Yeah, in some ways, I started this book in a way with the question, how did we become the most powerful people in history, most affluent by many measures, you know, all kinds of things, and the most lonely at the same time? Like, why is this world of so much power such a bad place to be a person? And I really was helped by a theologian named Craig Gay, who teaches at Regent College in Vancouver, who has a very good book of his own on technology. And he's the one who really got me thinking about this. And his orienting question is, why is so little technology actually helping us with what he calls ordinary embodied human life? Like just ordinary life. Why are we always being promised these amazing superpowers, but never just helped with being like an ordinary human being? And his basic answer is because it's not designed to serve persons. It's designed to serve commerce. I can't remember if he uses the word mammon, but if we take mammon to be, as I think Jesus used the word, the kind of spiritual principle, if not demonic principle, behind commerce that turns relationships into transactions and turns things into commodities, turns the created world, which is a gift from God, into a commodity just to be used by human beings mastering the world for themselves. That is what drives technology. Technology is adopted. It's developed and adopted. Not according to the question of, will this help me love the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength and love my neighbor as myself? Like, that is just not what's in the mind of any developer, any software engineer, any hardware engineer. What's driving it is, does this produce economic profit for some participant in the value chain of the modern market economy? And that's why Amazon, which when it started used UPS for their final mile delivery, and I knew the UPS driver who came because he had a route and he did the route every day and he knew most of the people on the route. And I don't know that I learned his name, but we definitely talked. I would absolutely recognize his face. I think I might even recognize it today, like 15 years later, because I saw him. I was a pretty heavy Amazon user pretty early on. Well, now, in an incredible optimization, Amazon now deploys gig workers and sometimes full-time employees on completely, to an ordinary human perspective, random routes, which is why you can't recognize anyone because you never see them more than once. Because every day their route is optimized not for what's going to be good for this employee whose work is to make that final mail delivery, which is good, that can be good human work to connect vendors and customers. There's nothing wrong with that. But what would be a good way to do that? Well, it would be one where you actually know the people you're serving, ideally on both ends of the value creation that is the essence of good work. But what Amazon's optimizing for is not the benefit of that employee. It's actually in some ways not even your benefit as a customer. It's to wring all the efficiency they can out of the system using algorithms that treat people as interchangeable units of labor. And it ends up with this world where we very rarely encounter another person with enough depth and time and presence to know them, which used to happen in commercial settings all the time. In retail, you would go to the corner store, you would know the people who worked in that store. Yeah. Now Amazon will happily let you into their grocery store where there is literally no one there. There's just stuff and you and your invisible money. And as you walk out, your invisible money is liberated from you very efficiently and you've got the stuff. But you haven't talked to a person, you haven't interacted with a person. And you multiply that by every sector of our economy and you realize this is all being designed in ways that absolutely increase economic profit, at least in the short term, but absolutely undercut the experience of being a person in the created gift of a world that we are in.
When you were writing in the book about the treating of someone as something and the way that this shift can happen in one's mind, and I think you mentioned there this loss of being able, for instance, to read irony. and those sort of, which is, I mean, one can just look at the trajectory of Twitter and Facebook conversations and definitely see that. I mean, there's no way that there's all kinds of jokes that someone could have made before that would be sarcastic or ironic, would never make now because there would be a response to it. And I was thinking about, I don't even remember who was writing about this, but about an artificial intelligence program that could read Macbeth and Hamlet and any work of literature and then tell you what it's about. So Macbeth is about ridding the conscience of guilt, and Hamlet is about ambiguity in the face of death. And you step back, you say, is that really though? Is the experience of reading Macbeth just about finding the abstraction behind it, or is there something a lot more, human and personal to it? And that, it seems to me, is a point that you are hitting kind of repeatedly here, is the lack of the lack of the personal. And that personal connection. And I wonder if you've seen this too in church life, in the sense of even just the way that we read the Bible. You might have one church that reads the Bible as a way to sort of pull out the practical applications for life.
Yeah, exactly.
And another church that would read it to sort of pull out the worldview axioms or the doctrinal sorts of tenets and depersonalize even the way that we hear from God.
Yes, yes. In which the Bible becomes a kind of technological device that delivers whatever commodity we happen to be looking for, whether it's practical life applications or doctrine or whatever. Yeah, that is interesting. I think what strikes me, all those misuses and misreadings in a way have in common, whether of the Bible or just someone's social media post, is it's a flattening and a loss of context, which I would connect very closely to mediated modes of expression always shrink bandwidth for the sake of efficient communication. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, and that's what writing does, of course. But what a really great reader does, in a way, is they, it's like written texts arrive almost like dehydrated. They have to be refilled with imagination to really understand, you know, to get that mirror neuron thing going. If you're in the congregation of the Romans, the first Romans, the congregation that received Paul's letter to the Romans, and that letter is carried to you, how does that get reanimated so you actually deepen and reform and reimagine your own life and your relationship with the Apostle Paul, who in this case they haven't even met at the time they get that letter? Well, great reading gives you access in a real way to the mind and heart and soul of another. And of course, we'd believe if it's the Bible, ultimately, the mind, if we can put it this way, the mind, heart, soul of God, the reality of God, the communication of God. But it requires a kind of contextual imagination that used to come semi-naturally to people. I won't ever say maybe ever fully naturally, because reading's sort of an unnatural thing in some ways. But we used to apprentice ourselves deeply enough to the Bible that its rich kind of imaginative resources were all available to us when we opened a given page. But once you stop doing that, it becomes just, it's just a device for inspiration or maybe information or maybe ideas, but not for imagination, not for connection and relationship, not for real presence. So I think that's happening. I mean, it, in some ways, it's most damaging when it attenuates the way that we read the Bible. But it's actually affecting the way we read everything and engage with everything. Is this kind of decontextualized, flattened, bandwidth shrunk use of the world and of texts for very narrow ends, rather than realizing, like, this is the whole problem with the Cliff Notes or Spark Notes approach to literature, right? What's Macbeth about? It's about a whole lot of things. It's not about one thing. So I think that's right. You know, I was, I don't mean to go on too long here, but I was in a setting recently where we were talking about what are the spiritual resources that we need as Christians to like survive and thrive in this very difficult world we find ourselves in. And one of the most like insightful things that was said is we need 150 Psalms. You really can't say, oh, well, you just need to learn lament. I mean, the Psalms have lament, but lament alone is not going to do it. And you can't say, as another kind of person might say, oh, we just need to learn how to praise, you know, how to trust God. No, you need 150 Psalms, many of which have these very unexpected turns in the middle of the Psalm where they start acting and behaving very differently toward God than they did at the beginning. Some of which end on real downer notes, others of which end with incredibly exalted notes. And you've somehow got to absorb that prayer book enough into your own heart, mind, and imagination that when you encounter the world, you've got that kind of repertoire of possibility available to you.
Yes. Yes.
But how often do we take the time to acquire the repertoire?
You even write, and it really struck me because it was something I've never thought about, I don't think, before. Romans, you mentioned the first Romans who would have received Paul's letter, but the importance of Phoebe and the importance of those who are not only just delivering the letter, but contextualizing it in relationship.
Yes.
And I don't think that's something I had ever thought about until then.
Totally. Making the neurological connection, right? Because Phoebe's been with Paul. She's there as he's finishing the letter, at least. And he's been teaching in her home and Gaius's home and Corinth, basically, Cenchreae. She's going to be with these human beings. There's going to be this kind of mirror neuron exchange between her and them. And so in a way, they're going to encounter Paul by someone who is neurologically shaped by this interpersonal encounter with him. And her presence is not ancillary to the letter. It opens up the letter to them. And what really struck me, this was a two-stage insight, Russell. So the first was that it's really interesting that Jesus never used media. So he never mediated his communication, ever. There's one time when it says he wrote on the ground, but we don't even know for sure that he's writing words, and in any case, it's not recorded what he wrote. It's gone by the end of the story. And so it strikes me that media is something you have to use when you're not yet fully human. If you're fully human, just being present in a particular place and time is enough for the transforming creative redemptive work of God to go forth in all its fullness from a single life lived in an unmediated way, unmediated with respect to other human beings, but also, of course, with respect to his Father, with whom he had kind of immediate relationship. Well, so when you point that out, people are like, well, but the first Christians wrote letters. And I think the reason is they weren't Jesus. They didn't have that entire fullness of life. But then what really struck me is we really have no evidence they ever sent letters without people. They always sent them with a person. And there were postal facilities, you could say, in the ancient world. They didn't have a postal service, but there were ways to get letters, you know, to a distant city, entrust them to a captain of a boat and pay him a little money and say, my friend will pay you more at the other end. But all the evidence we have is that these letters consistently are carried by a person. And then the really interesting corollary is the other form of mediation in our world is money, which is like the way to mediate the transfer of value. And we think, oh, I'd like to support that cause. I'll send them a check or I'll make an online donation. And the first Christians never send money without people either. In other words, they don't allow this replacement of personal relationship to infiltrate their engagements with each other. They keep it personal, even as they make use of the writing and the money, the collection for Jerusalem, the support of the various missionaries. But it's all done with persons in the loop rather than taking persons out of the loop.
Life is unpredictable. I think all of us learn that. Sometimes we learn it in good ways. Sometimes we learn it in really hard ways. You're valuable to Christianity Today, and we want you to be prepared and protected. And one of the ways that can happen is by having a will and getting a will together for your family and to care for your loved ones. If you've already set up your will and other important estate planning documents, that's great. But if you haven't, Christianity Today has partnered with Epic Will to easily and affordably walk you through the whole process of creating a legally binding and state-specific will in as little as 10 minutes. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones to take this vital step, and you can get started today by visiting morect.com/will. That's more with just one O, ct.com/will. And for a limited time, you can get 10% off. That's morect.com/will. You know, regular listeners to this show know that I'm kind of hammering all the time how metaphors matter and the unintentional metaphors like I just used of hammering. Now that I think
can't
about
help
it,
using them.
Yeah, it reveals something. And you talked about in the book even the example of this word impact, which I see increasingly even in church mission statements parachurch
council.
Yeah, it's everywhere. And you argue that that matters. Why is that the case?
Because it's a very misleading way of thinking about what does matter long-term in the shaping of culture and the shaping of individual lives. So we think impact to me is concentrated force over a short amount of time. The hammering accomplishes impact. That is, you use the hammer to concentrate the force and you move it very quickly so that when it hits that nail or whatever you're hammering home your point, you hope it will kind of go really fast and really effectively. And I mean, there's things in human history that have that kind of quality. They happen very quickly. They're quite dramatic in certain ways. The resurrection of Jesus happens like overnight. This world-altering infusion of life where there was death happens very suddenly. The conversion of Paul, you know, he's knocked off his horse. So I'm not saying there's not a time when God seems to act in these very, very dramatic ways. But the really interesting thing is that the cultural effect, that is the sort of way that those events came to have meaning and to matter for people like us thousands of years later, had very little of what we would call impact. That is to say, 50, 100, even 100 years after the death and, we believe, resurrection of Jesus, the Roman Empire barely knows it happened. It's not like an earthquake, even though Matthew says there was an earthquake, but that wasn't seen. It didn't create a social earthquake. Instead, it's much more like, you know, this metaphor Jesus uses. He uses several metaphors like this: the mustard seed, the little bit of yeast in the loaf, and I would call these metaphors of influence rather than impact. But or it's like the olive tree. I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. Blessed is the one who, follows the way of the Lord. He will be like a tree planted by waters. Well, how do trees make a difference? Not through these kind of sudden, dramatic, decisive concentrations of force, but instead through this kind of steady growth that nonetheless is inexorable and very powerful in the long run. But the quest for impact to me gets very bound up. I don't know that it always has to be this way, but it just does get bound up with the need to wield mammon, because money can get things done really fast, and the need to wield technology, because technology gets stuff done very fast. But is God actually in the business of getting stuff done very fast? At least when he employs us. I mean, he can if he chooses. But is that his way for us? I think we need to re-examine this metaphor and be very, very careful when we use it and why we use it.
I heard someone not long ago talking about how to tell if someone is rooted or unrooted. And he says, the question is, do you know the maiden names of your great-grandmothers? My first thought was, well, of course, who doesn't know the maiden names of their great-grandmothers? And my wife said, yeah, but you grew up in a Mississippi storytelling family, and most people in America don't. That kind of a household telling of the stories. Right. I was really moved in your book when you talked about what it means to be a household, and that's actually... that's the life we're looking for, yes. is to be part of a household. And you define it as when someone will be quieter when that person knows you're asleep, which yeah. I thought was a really powerful way to communicate it in many other ways. Yeah. How can we in this sort of really fragmented, lonely time find households?
Only through a certain amount of risk. Hmm. So I really do think this is the life we're looking for. You know, in some ways, the moment we're born, we're just looking, I think in a way, we're looking for mom. We're looking for one face. But in the long run, we're really looking to be enfolded in a durable relational community in which we're known, loved, loved after we're known, you know, instead of yeah. loved because we're not yet known. And intergenerational. And I would say not just the biological generations of your great grandparents, but the, in a sense, the generations of faith. I think we're meant to be part of not just a biological family, but the family of God, right? The household of God mm-hmm. is biblical language for the church. And that's where we find ourselves, right? But the problem is, to find that, especially on this side of the individualization that is the heritage of the Western world, the modern world, and especially the American story, the North American story, requires a kind of risk that we really, I think, when people realize what it costs to be known that way. So it costs a kind of stability, because you can't become known, truly known, quickly. And in some ways, unless you do have multi-generational kind of embeddedness, you're not actually known in the way human beings have always been known. And I think we're meant to be known. The Bible speaks of, you know, the book of Genesis is four generations from Genesis 12 to the end of Genesis. The Bible speaks of prosperity in terms of living to see your children's children and passing on good to your children. So there's this horizon, this long horizon, but that requires sticking around for that long.
Yeah.
Well, how many of us do that? How many of us opt out at some point, sometimes for very understandable reasons? And then it requires kind of the risk of opening yourself up in the moment to people. So my wife and I are living this right now because we've lived in a single family house, raising our two children who are now out of the house. And this year, my wife has a sabbatical from her college teaching job. And we decide to move and spend the year in the city of Boston, which is not where we normally live, but it is a place we used to live. And friends of ours, who we've known for 20 years since we moved away, had a first floor apartment in their house that they rent. And we said, we should rent from Simon and Manuela. So we're doing this interview. I'm downstairs from Simon and Manuela, who do literally move more quietly upstairs when they know we're asleep, because you hear every single footstep in this old kind of 1890s wood frame Boston house. And I will tell you, Russell, it is very vulnerable. Once you've gotten used to single family living in American suburbia, even as committed as you may say you are to Christian community and friendship, and I am committed to all these things, partnership, accountability, all that stuff. But to move into a house with other yeah. people who notice when we raise our voices mm-hmm. to each other, or when we don't actually seem to be talking to each other, or, you know, all the things you notice when you're proximate to people. But that the only way you're known is to open up your life like that. Mm. So it's this beautiful invitation that also just says, are you willing to risk it?
I'm imagining a listener to this show who would say, okay, you're right. The life that I'm looking for and the life that I'm longing for is not being met in the way that technology or mammon would tell me that it should be. I do want something different. But she says, what do I do tomorrow? What would you advise to do? Because a lot of people would say, okay, yes, Andy's right about all of that, but that's the way the world is now. And it's similar to the Luddites from before. And so we have to just, we have to just accept it.
Yeah.
What would you say to that listener about here are the things you should start doing? Or stop doing.
I don't quite put it this way in the book, but I think it is kind of the heart of the matter. I would say we need to put persons back in the loop of our daily lives. That is, there are still people around me there is someone who arrives to deliver the Amazon package. Now, many days I may not see them. I may miss it when they come. But I could, when I see that truck pull down my street, go outside. And just for a moment, I know they're on a schedule. I know they can't stop to talk really, but I could say hello. I could like bridge the gap of the assumption that this is just a functionary of a corporation who's meant to not trouble me. I could trouble myself to reinsert a personal connection where there wouldn't naturally be one. In a very small way, I try to do this when I have to do this terrible thing we all have to do now, which is wait on hold for a long time and then talk to someone at a call center. And who knows where this person is in the world. And they probably won't tell you their true first name. And, you know, they have a script they have to follow. But I've found that there are ways in most of these conversations to interject a note of human recognition. And it's kind of funny what happens. And it, kind of the amazing thing is how often we end up blessing each other at the end. Like very often this person at the end of the line is a fellow believer or at least believes in something like the God I believe in and wants good for me. And you just make these little connections in the way that I answer email, in the way that I work with my colleagues, in the way if you're working from home, which some people are, how do I actually like lean on any opportunity I have to reestablish a personal connection? That may sound inadequate because at some level, I mean, we're in trouble and this is civilizational trouble and any individual person only has so many degrees of freedom. But there's a moment like this in Romans 16 where Paul's dictating all these greetings. He's been dictating the whole letter. And like most ancient writers, he doesn't write it himself. He uses a scribe. And there's this moment where he stops and he says, well, we don't know for sure that he says this, but the voice of the letter changes. And it suddenly says, I, Tertius, who wrote down this letter, greet you in the Lord. So here's this person who's been anonymous. And at least to the reader of the letter, we don't know who this was. And we have to imagine Paul stops when at a moment he doesn't have to stop. And he says, oh, by the way, Tertius, you should absolutely write down your name, tell them hello, you know. What is that? It's bringing the person back in the loop. It's not treating him just like a function or a transaction. It's saying, here's another brother. And Tertius goes on to say, I'm in the home of Gaius. Erastus is here. The brother Quartus is here. You know, like he's got relationships that he brings into this letter that we think of as the letter of Paul. Then you have to, you know, you got to do that iteratively on more and more risky levels. One of my household questions is how many people have a key to your house? Maybe you don't have people who live with you, but surely there's someone who you ought to invite one step closer and say, hey, if you ever need to come over, here's the key. You're not inviting them to kind of violate your privacy, but you are saying, I'm making my life more permeable to someone who's close enough to me that we could actually know what it's like to be each other and have access to each other's lives and homes and family in the right way. You know, I do think, by the way, you know, as you know, from the book, the Roman Empire was a terribly impersonal place. I mean, Tertius' name means number three. He didn't even have a proper name. It was a world where unless you were of high status, you were treated as a thing. And of course, if you were a slave, you were literally treated under the law of things rather than the law of persons. And what the first Christians did is without initially any impact on the empire, they started treating one another and their neighbors and their enemies differently as persons. Because they saw in them the image of God and they saw in them someone for whom Christ had died. And I just think that's exactly the template. It's why I spend, in this book about technology, I spend about a third of it looking at the ancient world because I actually think the Roman Empire was a lot like our empire. And I actually think the hope of the church's response of reintroducing the truly personal in an impersonal world is the same thing. It's the same call today that it was for them 2,000 years ago.
And even before that, Pharaoh was very devoted to his name, building storage cities named after him. And he's never mentioned by name in Exodus, but the Hebrew midwives were.
Wow.
This is striking to see.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness. Exactly.
Well, Andy Crouch, before you go, someone asked me last week in one of our questions that came in, at what age should I allow my child to have a smartphone?
Yes.
And I'm wondering what your answer to that would be.
Yeah, well, my first answer usually is I think I managed to have a healthy relationship with my smartphone around 48 or 49 years old. So that would be my baseline recommendation. My honest, serious answer is, in the U.S., we generally start to entrust 16 or 17 year olds with two-ton assemblies of metal and glass that can do a lot of harm. So I think that's usually about the right to entrust them with a 6-ounce assembly of metal and glass that can do a lot of harm. So I think actually, if we think about analogously to driving, here's this technological thing that is part of our world that you do need to learn to handle. And we judge that teenagers with real limits are can be entrusted to some extent with the operation of a motor vehicle. I think that's about the same time that kids are prepared for the smartphone. And by the same token, we don't just hand kids the keys to the car. My friends at Screen Sanity, which is a great organization, have great, essentially driver's license for your phone kind of process for kids to go through with their parents. And they say, what do you do first? You watch someone else drive. And so are our kids seeing us using our phones in healthy ways? Then you drive with supervision and the parent or the teacher is looking over your shoulder. And then you're given limited access. You know, it's the same exact principle. And I think 16 is probably a reasonable time for that. With the same kind of boundaries and securities, in a sense, that we'd want to put on our own uses of it as adults, because we know our use of it can get very disordered too.
And that's Screen Sanity, is that right?
Screen Sanity. It's this beautiful organization that started by two moms in Kansas City who just said, let's start a totally different kind of conversation in our schools, our sports teams, our churches, and they have lots of great resources on this.
Well, the book is called The Life We're Looking For. Andy Crouch, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Russell.
Thanks for listening. Links are always in the show notes for resources mentioned in this episode, including a link about how you can have a trial membership to Christianity Today. Be sure to subscribe to the program, send an episode along to a friend who might benefit from it, and leave us a review when you can. It helps other people to find the show wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Russell Moore, and this is The Russell Moore Show from Christianity Today.
The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Executive producers are Eric Petrick, Russell Moore, and Mike Cosbert. Hosted by Russell Moore, produced by Ashley Hales. Associate producers Abby Perry and Azrae Phelps. CT administration provided by Christine Kolb. Social media by Kate Lucky. Director of operations for CT Media is Matt Stevens. Production assistance provided by Core Media. Audio engineer is Kevin Duthu. Coordinator is Beth Grabencourt. Video producer is John Rowland. The theme song for The Russell Moore Show is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hutton.